Good morning. It's great to see everybody. Happy New Year and welcome back. We were off last week, gave our volunteers and our staff a much needed break. I hope you had a wonderful week last week, and it's great to be back worshiping together. Before we jump into it, I want to just say thanks for a couple of things. One, I want to thank our worship team and those of you who showed up at Braddock Glen right before Christmas. Braddock Glen is a low-income assisted living. It's operated by Fairfax County, and we have a partnership with them. We're there every month. In fact, we're there this Sunday after this service doing some crafts with some of the residents there, so we'd love to have you go there today if you're interested. But every year, our worship team and some of you go and just lead in Christmas music, sing-along, carols, things like that, special music. And it's always a real treat for them. They always truly appreciate it. So thanks to those of you who helped do that. And then, for those of you, I mentioned this a couple of Sundays ago, but those of you who went to the Lamb Center and helped us with that because it was a little bit a bigger deal this past month than normally because it was Christmas and we were expecting a larger crowd and we were doing a little bit bigger dinner for the homeless folks at the Lamb Center. And we had somewhere around 130, maybe something over 130 folks that our teams fed there. So thanks for helping with that. And then thank you for just being a part of Living Nativity this year. We had lots and lots of people from our community and we got lots of feedback about how much it means to people every year to kind of have this experience that they can walk into and have that kind of a unique worship experience. So thanks to those of you who participated in some way, whether you're a live character or you brought food or you helped with setup and takedown and all of that. It was a great, great success. So let's go to God in prayer this morning. God, we thank you for this past year as we just kind of look back real quickly at what you did in and through us and what you allowed us as a church to be a part of, is what you allowed us as individuals to be a part of, and we thank you for that. And then we just look forward to this next year in 2020 at all the things that you're going to do, you're going to invite us to be a part of, the things that you're going to do in and through us. And so we just thank you in advance for that. And now, God, I pray that you just open our hearts and our minds as we begin to look into Scripture this morning. I just pray that you would open our hearts and minds to see what you want us to see, to know what you want us to know, but ultimately to do and what you want us to do and be what you want us to be. In Christ's name I pray, amen. So we are starting a brand new series this morning. We're going to be in for the next 3 weeks. I want to highly encourage you to be here all 3 weeks. This is kind of one of those series that kind of builds on itself, and we'll wrap it up in 3 weeks. And we're calling it Good News, and there's a question mark there. And the reason that there's a question mark there is because for a lot of people, resistance to Christianity revolves around this question right here. Is it true? Is it true? And maybe that's you, or maybe at some point in your life that was you, or maybe you know someone that just doesn't believe, and they have good reasons for not believing. But for a lot of people, this is the question that they wrestle with is when I think about Christianity, is it true? But more and more, and this is what we're going to talk about in this series, more and more in our culture, and this just hurts me as a pastor, and it hurts me as a follower of Jesus, but more and more in our culture, especially for our younger generation, the question isn't, is it true anymore? The question is becoming more and more, is it good? Is Christianity good? Even if it's true, is it good? Even if it's partially true, is it good? Is Christianity good for society? Is it good for the culture? Is it good for humanity? Is it good for me? That when it comes to Christianity, more and more people who are outside looking in are asking the question, not is it true, but is it good? Now, to kind of get us focused on where we're going this morning, when you hear news that's not good, don't you hope that it's not true? Right? When you hear news and it's not good news, don't you think to yourself, man, I hope that's not true. I mean, that's just human nature. When we hear something that's not good, you hope it's not true. For example, if you heard that Apple was going out of business and there was never, ever going to be another iPhone, right? You would hope that that's not true, wouldn't you? Or if you heard that Amazon was going to go back to only selling books and now we have to all go back to the mall to do our shopping, that's not good news, is it? And we would hope that it's not true. So when you hear news that's not good, you hope that it's not true. But the opposite is true as well, right? When you hear news that is good, don't you hope that it's true? I mean, imagine this right here, right? Processed sugar extends life expectancy, right? I mean, is that not just the best news ever? I mean, I didn't get a woohoo in the first service, but I did this one. I mean, we can all go back to drinking regular sodas, right? I can eat Frosted Flakes again for breakfast. We can start putting sugar on everything, you know, stamping everything that can contain sugar and all of that stuff. Now, this is not true. Please don't write this down and quote me. This is not true. But, I mean, isn't this just like one of the best clickbaits in the history of clickbait? Because you would click on that, wouldn't you? I'd click on that in a heartbeat. Processed sugar extends life expectancy. And when we saw that, for most of us, that would be good news, wouldn't it? So you would hope that it's true. Now, it wouldn't necessarily be true, and the fact that you hope it's true doesn't make it true. And to be very clear, the fact that it's good news doesn't even make it true, does it? My point is this. When you hear something that's good, you hope it's true. You lean in to that. That's just human nature. So when the announcement of Jesus' birth came, we celebrated this last week. When the announcement of Jesus' birth was first being announced, it was described on day one. It was described from the beginning. It was described as good news, right? That it was good news, and it was good news of great joy. And then here was the surprise. I mean, nobody in Jesus' day, nobody was expecting this. The message of Jesus was good news of great joy, the angel announced, and it was to all people. It was for everyone. The message of Jesus, and they didn't even know what the message of Jesus was at this point, but the message of Jesus would be good news of great joy, and it would be for all people. It would be for Jews and Gentiles, for Romans and Samaritans, for men, women, for children, for anyone who ever lived. The message was so good that it would create great joy for all people. So here's the question. Is it? Was it? And if so, why the resistance today? Because like I said, when you hear good news, you hope it's true. You may find out somewhere along the way that it's not true, but you hope it's true. When you hear good news, you lean in to that, don't you? And if people lean into good news, then why isn't everybody in our world, and why isn't everybody in our nation, and why isn't everybody in our communities leaning in, hoping that it's true, even if they decide at the end of the day that it's not true? In fact, the original version was not called the Bible. The original version was actually called Good News. It was actually called the Gospel. I mean, when they were trying to think of what they were going to call this, they said, what are we going to call this? And they came up with the Gospel. The Gospel comes from two old English words. You may know what these mean. It means God spell, which literally means good story. So when they were putting together the scriptures and they were trying to figure out what are we going to call these, they said, we know what we'll call them. It's good news, because this is a good story. In the first century, when they were trying to decide that's what they came up with, and the message of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus, and the claims of Jesus caught on in the first century. And here's why. Because when you hear something you consider to be good news, you lean in before you know whether it's true or not. But initially, you lean in. And in the first century, people leaned in when they heard the story of Jesus. And one of the things that breaks my heart, about this generation is that we are seeing so many people who are leaning away from the message of Christianity because somewhere along the way, they've drawn the conclusion that it's not good news. And it's not their fault. And if this is you, it's not your fault, because you bumped into, you ran into, you did business with, you went to school with, you were raised by some people who carried a version of Christianity, who carried a version of the message of Jesus, and you determined somewhere along the way, this is not good news, and I don't even care if it's true or not. It's not good news, and so I don't want any part of it. You should know. You should know the original news. It was good, and it was compelling. So if the life and teaching of and the message of Jesus doesn't strike you as good news, perhaps it's because the version you grew up with, or the version you walked away from, or the version maybe you're even thinking of walking away from, maybe it wasn't the original version. It wasn't the good news, because the original version, like I said, it was compelling and it was worth telling. Now, This is amazing, and we're going to talk about this along the way, and we don't really get this so clearly because of the way the Bible is kind of presented to us today, but this is amazing. In the first century, very few people had their stories told. In the first century, and even in the second and third century, very few people had their stories documented because most people couldn't read, and writing materials were so expensive. The only way you got your story told was you had to be wealthy, and you had to hire somebody to record the events of your life. So as a result, in ancient times, pretty much the only people who we know anything about much are wealthy, important, famous people who paid somebody to write their story, and then they would edit their story to make sure it made them look really good, right? And so the fact that we have even one account of the life of Jesus is just amazing, because at that time, he wasn't famous. I mean, he wasn't wealthy. Jesus was a day laborer from Galilee. And when his story was written, he was already gone. He wasn't around to pay somebody to write his story. And Luke, at the very beginning of his account of the life of Jesus, with the very first word that Luke writes, he says something that I think should make all of us just sit up and take note. And what he writes, it's so easily overlooked, but it's so historically significant for us. The very first word of his gospel in Luke says something that should just make us all kind of stop in our tracks and pay attention. And here's what he says. He says, many. Many. This is the very first word in the Gospel of Luke. Many. Now, how many is many? Well, that depends on what we're talking about, right? I mean, if we're talking about how many are here this morning, that's one thing. If we're talking about the stars in the sky, that's something else, right? So how many is many? It depends. But unless you're talking about kids, 4 is not really many, is it? How many is many? Is 40 many? Maybe so. But listen to what Luke says. This is from the first century, and he says, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. And this is amazing to me, and here's why. Luke is saying, I'm about to give you an account of the life of Jesus, but you need to know my account is not the only one. And neither is Matthew's, and neither is John's, and neither is Mark's. He says, many other people have endeavored to draw up an account of the things that we have seen happen in our time, of the things that have been fulfilled among us. Now, let me ask you this question, and I'm not trying to make you feel bad about yourself when I ask this question, but we live in modern times, right? And it's anyone can write a book today. Anyone can get a book published. It's pretty easy. It's not all that expensive to do. It's easy to write down a record of someone's life. So let me ask you, do you know how many people will undertake to draw up an account of your life? I do. Not, right? As in, not many will do it. And think about it. I mean, it would be so cheap and so easy for someone to do that. And you're wonderful people, and I'm a wonderful person, but there's not a bunch of people lining up to draw up an account of our lives, is it? So this is the question I think we should all be asking as we look at Luke, is why so many? Why so many? Why did so many people try to document the life of someone who had come and gone and was basically at that time a nobody from nowhere? Why so many? Someone who'd basically only traveled a few miles from where he was born and where he grew up, who didn't write anything, who wasn't really in the public eye very long. Jesus was only in the public eye maybe 3 to 4 years, something like that. Why did so many people want to capture his story? And the answer is this. Because in the first century, in the land of Judea, something significant happened. Something significant happened. And the reason it was documented by so many people is because something good happened. So, I don't know what version of Christianity you grew up on, but the original version, it was good. It was all good. And it was so good that people wanted it to be true before they were even convinced it was true. And here's what Luke goes on to say. He tells us many have undertaken to draw up an account of these things that have been fulfilled among us. And he says, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Luke's saying, look, I'm not putting a bunch of stories together that I've just kind of heard along the way, and I'm not making this stuff up. He says, these are eyewitnesses' accounts. He said, I've talked to the people who were there. I talked to the people who knew Jesus, who walked along with Jesus. These were servants of Jesus. And he says, with this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated, again, I'm not just telling you a bunch of stories that I heard through the rumor mill. He says, I've investigated this. I've investigated everything from the beginning. And then he says, I too. Why I too? Because I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one who did this. I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. Now, we don't know who Theophilus was. Scholars believe that Theophilus probably was a wealthy person. They believe he was probably a curious Christian who had heard some of the stories of Jesus and wanted to know more. He wanted to know the full story of Jesus from beginning all the way to the end. And so they think he went to Luke and he asked Luke, would you use your skills and would you investigate this and would you take the time to write me an orderly account of this man's life? And Luke did that. And then listen to what Luke says next to Theophilus. He says, Theophilus, the reason I did this for you, and the reason he did it for us, was this, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you've been taught. Theophilus, you've been taught the life and the message of Jesus, but I want you to have confidence in what you've been taught. So I'm putting together an orderly account of what happened in the life of Jesus. And little did Luke know, and I think this is just incredible, but little did he know that this account that he was writing for a single individual would be one of four accounts of the life of Jesus that would survive antiquity. I mean, I think that's just amazing. So why was this story, why was it worth telling? I mean, this story was worth telling because it was good. And when people heard it in the first century, they leaned in hoping that it was true. You know, one of the things that Jesus said, that he said about himself, was that he had come to forgive people of their sins. And when he claimed that, I mean, it turned things upside down. I mean, it created so much havoc, so much upheaval with the religious establishment, because they had a very sophisticated temple system, a very sophisticated sacrificial system that had been around for thousands of years. And that system was in place, and it had made people rich, and it had made people very, very powerful in that day and age. And in fact, we're gonna talk about that forgiveness of sin in detail next week and what that looks like in light of Jesus' life. So don't miss next week. But the good news was even better than that. I mean, the good news of Jesus was better than forgiveness of sin. And here's why I say that. According to Jesus, anybody, and no other religion offers this, but according to Jesus, anybody, regardless of their starting point, regardless of where they are, regardless of what they know, and even regardless of what they believe, anybody can choose to take a step and follow Jesus from where they are right now. Everyone is invited to take a step to follow Jesus. And that is incredible news. And we know this because, once again, Luke records an event for us. And he records an event where Jesus and some of his guys, some of his closest followers, his disciples, were walking down a road, and they come to this intersection. And they call it a highway. We wouldn't really refer to it as a highway as we consider highways today. But they get to this intersection on this Roman highway, and they get to it, and it's a toll booth. And we know what those are, right? And so they get to the toll booth, but instead of a plastic arm that comes down, there was a Roman spear. And so everybody had to stop and pay the toll. And the guy who's sitting there collecting the toll in Luke's account is a guy by the name of Levi. So Levi, he's a tax collector for the Roman Empire. And you know this because we talked about this, but the reputation of tax collectors in that day and age was a lot worse than tax collectors today, right? Tax collectors, their reputation was just horrible. They didn't have any friends other than other tax collectors because nobody wanted to hang around with them. I mean, they were considered so bad and so sinful that they weren't allowed anywhere in the temple, and they weren't even allowed near the temple. They were considered, as Jewish people, they were considered ceremonially unclean, and God would never bless them, and God surely would never love them. That's Levi. And Jesus walks up to Levi, and he says this, and maybe it was for your sake and my sake that Luke captured this, but he says to Levi, he says, Levi, follow me. Follow me. And Levi was probably like, Are you kidding me? I mean, you're a rabbi, and I know you're a rabbi because I see your rabbinical robes, and I see that you've got followers with you. And by the way, your followers are kind of giving me the evil eye, like he's not going to be a part of our group, is he? Right? And Jesus, look, no rabbi has ever asked me to follow him. I mean, in fact, do you know what the rabbis say about me? I mean, they use me in their sermons, right? I'm a negative sermon illustration in rabbi sermons, right? Be careful that you don't grow up to be like Levi, the tax collector. Be careful you don't grow up to be a tax collector. And Jesus, you're saying to me, you want me to follow you? And Jesus said, yes, Levi, I want you to follow me. And Levi, I understand what your reputation is. And Levi, I understand who you are. And Levi, I understand what you're doing because you're doing it right now. And I get all of that. And in spite of all of that, Levi, I want you from right where you are to follow me. Isn't that good news? I mean, that regardless of how low you go, or how far you wander, or regardless of what you've done or what you become, that Jesus says, you can start right there, right where you are, and you can follow me. That's good news. But it got even better than that. And here's why I say that, because Jesus' followers, they were not only invited to follow him, and they weren't just invited to be good. I mean, this, and unfortunately, right here, this is where the message of Christianity stops for, I think, way too many people, because for far too many people, it goes like this. I know I need to be good. I can't be good. And the people who claim that they are good, they're not even that good. They're just a bunch of hypocrites. And so I don't want to be a part of that. But Jesus didn't stop there. In fact, Jesus didn't even really start there with being good. That's why Levi could follow him. He called his followers not simply to be good, but to do good, but not in the usual way. Because everybody does good, right? And here's what he says. He says, if you're going to follow me, and if you're going to be like me, then I want you to do good, but I want you to do good to those who hate you. And I want you to pray for those who mistreat you. Who does that? They would ask. To which Jesus would say, hang on, because you're about to learn something about God that no one has ever told you before. He said, if you do good to those who do good to you. I mean, that's just average. Everybody does that. That's unremarkable. He says, what credit is that to you? I mean, that brand of good, he's saying, that's been around since the beginning of time, right? But then Jesus kind of leans in to his listeners and he says, but love your enemies. Do good to them and lend to them without expecting anything back. And are you ready for the next part? Because what he says next, the people who were there, they probably thought to themselves, okay, this can't possibly be true, but if this is true, this changes everything for us. He said, if you are that good, if you embrace this level of good that I am calling you to as my followers, if you choose to do good to those who mistreat you and those who cheat on you and those who are not good to you in return, if you choose to be good to those who can't offer you anything in return, he says, you will be called children of the Most High God, Most High, because that's what your Father in heaven is like, that he is good to those who hate him and he loves those who mistreat even those that he loves, because he, God, is kind to the ungrateful, and he's kind to the wicked. And that right there is good news. You know why it's good news? Because I've been ungrateful. And it's good news because I've been wicked. And my guess is most of you here have too. So Jesus, let me just get this straight. You're telling me that you represent God, and you're telling me that God is kind to the ungrateful people and the sick people. See, that's good news. And again, that may not be the God that you are presented with, but you need to understand that God, as presented by Jesus, was and is a God of extraordinary mercy to the ungrateful and to the wicked. But this is confusing to us, isn't it? It's confusing to us because that's not how most Christians act, is it? And why is it? And we're going to talk about this on week three, so don't miss week three. But why is it that our reputation as Christians isn't always like the reputation of God that Jesus presented over 2,000 years ago? Why aren't we known for being kind to the ungrateful and the wicked? And why are we not known for being merciful to the merciless? Why are we not known for serving people who don't even want to have anything to do with us, much less want to give anything back to us? Why isn't the reputation of Christians in this country so good that people look at us and go, they're crazy? I mean, just try to offend them. You can't do it. Try to make them angry. Try to make them mad. It's as if they're from a completely different world. It's as if they serve in a completely different kingdom with completely different values. And I'll tell you why. Because too many Christians, and I hope we're not these kinds of Christians, but too many Christians for too many generations have been content to believe, have been content to simply believe, but not follow. And believing makes absolutely no difference in this world. Following makes all the difference in the world. That is why Jesus' initial invitation to us was not believe in me. It was follow me. Because if you follow me, you will discover that following me will make you your life better and will make you better at life. And you will follow me because of who I claim to be. Even at the end of the day, you're not sure if it's all true. You will know that it's all good. And listen to what Jesus says next. He says, and be merciful, followers of Jesus. He says to you and me, he says, be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Now, what is not to love about that? What is not good news about that right there? If you grew up on a version of Christianity where God was anything but merciful, I'm sorry. It was not the original version. That is not good news. Jesus' message was good news, of great joy, and it was for all people. And so back to the question that we started with, and we'll wrap up, and it's this. Is Christianity good? Is Christianity good? Is it good for society? Is it good for a culture? Is it good for your family? Is it good for you? Is it good for me? Luke thought so. Mark thought so. Matthew and John thought so. Peter thought so. James, the brother of Jesus, thought so. Paul eventually thought so. Many, many others thought so. Because the original version was good. The original version was good news, and it was compelling news. And when it is presented in its rawest and clearest and most uncluttered form, I'm convinced, because Jesus said so, and because this is what the first century church teaches us, I'm convinced that people will want to the message of Jesus to be true, even before they're convinced whether it is true. So, if you don't buy it because it never sounded good, then maybe you didn't hear the original it. And maybe you grew up with the wrong it. And maybe somewhere along the way someone misused it. And if that's the case, then again, I'm sorry. Because you need to know the people who were closest to Jesus were convinced that they had met good in a body because they had met God in a body. And they were convinced, and so they captured it, and they wrote it down because they were convinced that the message of Jesus wasn't just for their generation, that it was for generations to come, that it was for every generation. And so they were convinced that it was absolutely true and that it was good news of great joy for all people. And we're going to pick it up right there next week. So don't miss next week. But before we go, I just want to leave you with two questions, and we're going to come back to these questions on week three as we kind of wrap all of these up, but just two questions to think about this week, and here's the question. The first one is this: in what ways has a church made the good news not so good? In what ways has the church made the good news not so good? And if you've experienced that firsthand, I'd love to hear your story, because I want to learn, because I want to make sure we're never a church like that, that we're always a church that is presenting as best we can, and nobody's perfect at this, the clearest form of the good news, the message of Jesus. And then the same question, just a little more personal. But in what ways have you, in what ways have I, in what ways have we made the good news not so good for the people around us? Think about those questions this week, and don't miss next week as we continue. Let me pray for you. God, I thank you for the good news. God, I thank you for the celebration of Christmas that we just celebrated, and you coming to this world, and the angel's announcement that this is good news of great joy for all people. But he didn't start there. You went all the way to the cross to give your life for us. And God, I thank you for Luke. I thank you for Matthew and Mark. I thank you for John, who, among many other people, who captured the story of your life and the message of your life, and that we have that today. I thank you that it's been protected all of these years, through the translations. I thank you for people like Paul and Peter and James, who came along and added to that and helped us understand how to apply what you taught to our lives and to the church. And God, I pray that churches would rise up and they would begin to be churches that truly do express the original version that the first century church expressed. I pray that we would be that kind of church. And because of that, I pray that people would lean in, whether they believe it's true or not, or they're convinced that it's true or not, they would lean in because what they hear and what they see to them is truly good news. So help us be that kind of church. But then more than that, God, I pray that as we leave, as your followers, we would be that kind of people wherever we are and with the people that we meet. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.